welcome everyone. It is a really exciting time to be gathering, just sort of in the wake of the huge victory of the Amazon workers on Staten Island. And I'm sure you have all sent your congratulations and maybe been riding a slight high since that win. And I mean, that comes right after the just building momentum of the Starbucks workers across the country with wins and more filings. And it's quite an exciting time. So I'm glad that we can all be together to discuss that. And I think, you know, there's questions like, will we see a wave of unionization amongst Amazon employees and warehouses after the Staten Island victory? Will it sort of progress in a similar way that the Starbucks workers have progressed? I think it'll definitely encourage workers in other industries and other settings to really aim high and be bold and think outside the box of how to start making significant gains for working people. So I think it's definitely time for us to discuss what DSA can do in the labor arena and what socialists can contribute. So I'm glad that you're all here to have that discussion today. By way of introduction, my name is Sarah Kimmerly. I am a nurse practitioner. I'm a member of SEIU 1199 Northwest. I was on the bargaining team and I am running for the executive board. I'm a member of Seattle DSA and of the Reform and Revolution Caucus. So yeah, we wanna welcome you to this discussion that R&R is hosting. We're a Marxist caucus within DSA. We're gonna start with two speakers just to sort of frame the discussion a bit in the current context before we go to our panelists for a deeper dive into DSA's debate about labor. Our panelists are Laura Gabby. She is a member of the NPC, the National Political Committee, a member of the Bread and Roses Caucus, and a union carpenter. Paul K.D. is a labor activist in the Twin Cities and a rank-and-file member of UFCW Local 663. He's a socialist and a member of the Tempest Collective and DSA, and one of the founders of their restaurant organizing project. And then lastly, for our last panelist, we have Ty Moore. He is a union organizer with AFSCME, a longstanding activist in the Fight for 15 and the Marxist movement, and the father of a lovely young daughter and a member of the Reform and Revolution Caucus. So before we get started, so we want to frame the discussion, as I said, in sort of the current developments and DSA's work. And so I'll tell you who our second speaker is, and then we'll introduce the first speaker. Our second speaker is Laura Wadlin. You can see her there. She is a former co-chair of the Portland DSA, where the comrades there have done a fantastic model of strike solidarity and labor focused and oriented socialist work. So we'll hear from her in a moment. However, we wanted to start with James Scretta. And I can see you on the screen. Great. Everybody speaks about Starbucks, about the wave that workers in Buffalo, New York triggered of unionizing, of an exciting inspiration to the whole labor movement. James was at the heart of it. He's a Starbucks barista and an organizing committee member with Starbucks Workers United in Buffalo. So if you could both of you outline in about 5 minutes what you've done, what you see, what you see you've got going and what the next steps are. So as I said, we'll start with James. Unmuted, great.
Hi, sounds like my audio is coming through okay. Is it fine? Super happy to be here. I'm not sure if I'll be able to stick around for the conversation that happens afterwards, but I'm excited for y'all to be having the meeting today and getting a good conversation going. So I'm James, I'm a barista at the Sheridan and Bailey store up in Buffalo. We had our union election vote counted a little over 3 weeks ago now, and we ended up winning our election as we expected that we were. We were, I think, then the fourth unionized Starbucks store. We're up to 10 total now. We've gotten a really massive victory on the same day as the Amazon vote count earlier in the week at the New York City Reserve Roastery, which is essentially Howard Schultz's crown jewel. So we know that he's having a great time right now. We, in our massive organizing spree, we've managed to push out a CEO of a Fortune 500 company, and Howard Schultz is now unfortunately back. And you know, he has a huge reputation as a union buster. When he came in to be the CEO about 30 years ago, you know, one of his first tasks was to really take control of the company and control labor and push out any effort to grow the union movement within baristas and Starbucks. And we expect nothing less from him as this battle continues to move forward. What's been really outstanding in our organizing model that I think really is reflected in the Amazon victory at JFK 8 is that we're basically a worker-driven organizing program. We absolutely have critical support from Workers United, and we're proud to be affiliated under Workers United. And we need to give the biggest shout outs to the leaders of that union, particularly in the upstate New York area. Gary Bonadonna took a massive risk. He's the leader of the Rochester Regional Joint Board. He took a massive risk supporting us as we started to organize over the summer. You know, this being an outgrowth of sentiments of frustration and a desire to organize that existed throughout the entirety of the pandemic. But beyond, you know, financial support through the burgeoning legal fees that are just are necessary to compete with the company and to just engage in the NLRB election process, and some great advice from people like Richard Bensinger, who is a former AFL-CIO organizing director, who was actually pushed out because of his more radical approach to trying to grow rank and file leadership and making sure that it's the rank and file that is leading the union movement. You know, beyond that kind of support, you know, it's a very, very worker-centric and worker-led program. As stores file, have their election, go through the process and begin bargaining, we essentially through that experience have workers who are trained to help coach other stores. And that's the model that has been spreading and helping to make this movement grow so quickly. I think we all saw it, you know, from what is being reported early about the Amazon labor union, is there's a really similar kind of idea going on there where, you know, the workers themselves are the leaders, and the workers themselves as the leaders make it impossible for the company to use the most commonly used anti-union tactic, which is to third party the union. You know, call the union a group of people from the outside who are here to, you know, take your dues. And I think there's some meaningful critique that, you know, us Starbucks workers, and definitely probably to the workers at Amazon, have a big union organizing strategy. You know, honestly, I really think the only way that we're going to have revolution is if the workers themselves are leading it. And I think the results of the early results of these two movements are showing just how much that can lead to meaningful wins. It's a strategy that unfortunately has not been cultivated and developed well, but hopefully we'll be at the forefront of how people who are organizing move forward. So if you want to help Starbucks workers, if you want to be a part of this, really the best thing that you could do is, if you don't have time yourself, if you don't have a boatload of time yourself, find out who the organizing committee members are at whatever local store is organizing near you. And if you do find yourself with lots of spare time, or you happen to be unwaged, it is never a bad time to get a job at Starbucks. It is never a bad time to find six or seven of your friends and find a local cafe chain decide that you all want to invest a significant amount of time of your life to like getting to know that cafe and just go work there. Honestly, it's not something I would advise if you're not actually committed to working. You know, something that is important about all of the worker leaders is that they care about the workplace that they are in, and they're not there to incite a revolution. You know, it's like, I love working at Starbucks and I love the customers who come in and the space that it is. And when you love something, it makes you better suited to actually be able to fight for what it is that that space is there to do. So
great.
Good luck, everyone.
Thank you so much. That was really inspiring. If you have any links you want to drop in the chat for anyone, please go ahead and do that. And I'm glad that you highlighted that it isn't just Starbucks stores that are unionized, that there have been a number of coffee shops around the country that are also moving into getting organized. So thank you very much. And next up, as I said, is Laura Wadlin, a former co-chair of Portland DSA, where I said before, they've done this model work in labor-focused socialist organizing. So I'll turn it over to Laura. Thank you.
Hi, thanks for having me. Yeah, my name is Laura. I'm a member of the Bread and Roses Caucus, and I'm a union teacher at Portland Community College. This is my union. And yeah, so over the past 6 to 9 months, Portland DSA has done several community solidarity campaigns with local unions that went on strike or were forming unions in the case of Starbucks. And we started that in a major coordinated way last summer with a Nabisco strike, which you might have heard about, right? No contract, no snacks. And what we did was have regular picket line presence from DSA members. They had a 24-hour picket line, 24-hour, 7 days a week picket line. They were on strike for 40 days. And we were there both at punctuated points, holding community rallies for them, which we organized, had somewhere between 100 to 300 people at every single rally. And we also were present on the picket line outside of rallies too. And the thing that I took away from that DSA members need to do, the model that DSA members need to follow, is you need to be on that damn picket line. When there is a picket line for whatever reason, whether it's a strike or not strike, you know, lots of unions hold, they call them informational pickets or rallies. Socialists need to be there to show why we care about a strong labor movement and talking about our politics with the workers on the line and making those relationships. And so when you bring your fellow DSA members or fellow union members, hopefully, to a picket line, it's going to be very tempting to just sort of stand there next to your friend that you came with and, you know, hold a sign and say, yeah, this is cool, this is fun. And not talk to anybody. And I'm telling you, you have to resist the temptation to be a wallflower at the picket line. It's your job to talk to the workers that are there. Ask them, you know, what motivated them to do this. Tell them how much you support them. And while we don't want to be super aggressive salespeople about DSA, that I don't think that would be a good idea. We don't want to be hesitant to talk about our politics as socialists and why we are so happy to see them doing what many of us don't even ever get a chance to do, which is stick it to our boss and stand up for our rights and for our coworkers and for the well-being of our community. So having those political conversations with workers is so important, and developing the relationships with workers is so important. You should introduce yourself to workers on the picket line. You should, again, ask them about the experience of being on strike or forming the union or whatever it is they're going through. And then, like, ask their name, remember their name, maybe get their contact information, follow them on social media, send them pictures of being on the picket line, and come back and develop that relationship later. Really, those relationships are what's going to collapse the gap between the socialist movement and the labor movement. And you don't have to wait until a picket line just pops up out of nowhere. You actually should be researching ahead of time what the major contracts are in your area. So knowing, you know, okay, the teachers union, right? When does their contract expire? You know, keeping like monitoring the social media accounts of major unions so that you can see, oh, they're having a rally. We should go to that. We should make those relationships, right? Like you should be proactive. And in fact, one of our best campaigns, our solidarity campaign with the Oregon Federation of Nurses and Health Professionals, we never even stood with them on a strike line a single day, but we worked with them for 3 weeks before they were planning on going on strike, talking to their members, organizing like solidarity actions, like we were planning on submitting patient complaints, things like that. We worked with them for 3 weeks, and that was enough for their executive board to decide to donate $10,000 to Portland DSA instead of donating it to the Democratic Party, because they saw DSA as actually doing something for them and representing their interests, which is really crazy and amazing. But of course, you can't just be on the outside forever. Socialists also need to be on the inside. And so that's why we need to take rank and file jobs. We need to be there in the labor movement. One of the other campaigns we did was with City of Portland workers. And the only reason we were able to have a major impact on that potential strike campaign, and the only reason we were able to make relationships with multiple workers at the City of Portland, was because there was one socialist in that department in the City of Portland who said, hey, my union is like, I think maybe thinking about going on strike. I need to get it, and I need to get DSA connected with this. Just one guy who was a socialist on the inside and made that connection, and that turned into this huge, amazing strike solidarity campaign. So I'm really happy that in Portland, we have a huge cadre of Teamsters at UPS. We have about, I think, like somewhere around 15 or so Teamsters working at UPS. And honestly, the people that are involved in that cadre have told me it's like been a life-changing experience to, you know, wake up every day with a purpose and people around you who believe what you do. So yeah, get on that picket line, get a union job, and the labor movement and the socialist movement are gonna unite.
Excellent. Really, really inspiring work. And I hope we can all take that back into our chapters and take that inspiration back and do similar work. So now we will jump to our panel discussion, and then we'll have time for group discussion afterwards. But we're going to start off our panel with just a rapid fire question with a yes or no only answer and no explanation. And then we'll have questions after that where folks can expand upon their thoughts. And so the question for everyone is, rank and file strategy, does it work for DSA? And so we will start with Laura Gabby, a member of the NPC, a member of the Bread and Roses Caucus, and a union carpenter. So welcome, Laura. Does rank and file strategy work for DSA?
Thanks. It works for building a mass socialist movement and merging the labor and socialist movements, a place we desperately need to get to if we hope to win socialism in our lifetimes. So while DSA very much needs to play a role in it, it will never live solely in DSA. It's meant to be enacted in our workplaces and alongside our coworkers and in unions.
All right. Few more words than one, but I appreciate your answer. Next up is Paul KD, a member of the Tempest Collective. Rank and file strategy, does it work for DSA?
Maybe.
Okay. We'll let you expand on it in further questions. Next up is Ty Moore, union organizer with UFCW, longstanding activist in the fight for 15 in the Marxist movement, and a member of Reform and Revolution. Does the rank and file strategy work in DSA?
Well, I thought I had one sentence too, but I'll just say.
Oh, you're right. It was one sentence. I thought it was one word. I'm just trying to keep the panelists. Sorry for giving you a hard time.
Okay, well, my one sentence is, I think DSA's formal adoption of the rank and file strategy was a big step forward, even if its implementation has faltered. Because I think the original articulation of it by Kim Moody firmly ties labor work of socialists to the wider political goal of a socialist transformation of society. I bet Paul should get a sentence too, just to be fair.
You want to come back, Paul, to expand?
Okay, yeah, this is the one sentence I wrote. if we believe that we, the working class, can liberate ourselves, then yes.
Great, thank you. And thank you for all giving me some time to sort this out. All right, so the next question, and we're gonna go in the order of Paul, Ty, and then Laura for this question. Where is labor at? What is the state of the union movement? How do you see it? And each of you will have 5 minutes. So we'll turn it over to you, Paul, and I'll just message you directly if you're getting close to time.
Okay, great. So before I say anything else, people are fighting back every day against their bosses. They've done it since we've had bosses, and we'll do it until we finally ended this exploitation. So great, right? Still, the labor movement overall, not in great shape today. The vast majority of workers are ununionized. For many parts of the US, unions are basically non-existent, as well as in many sectors, service industry. Obviously, we've been in bad spots before, and countries like Brazil, South Korea, South Africa have built incredibly vibrant unions in much harder conditions. But what is continually worrying is about this is the weakness of the response to the situation by labor. So most unions are not particularly democratic, are not doing a convincing job organizing new workers, have done a pretty bad job responding to the COVID crisis. As an example, since the pandemic, my UFCW local has had really no response to the almost massacre we've seen in meatpacking. And we haven't had any real union meetings. We have teleconferences, yes, calls where the president like will drone on for a while about whatever's on his mind. And in the political realm, many union members in sectors like manufacturing or skilled trades voted for Trump back in 2020 with no real effort by leadership to change the state of affairs. Now that we're in the Brandon regime, there has been a push for the PRO Act that basically kind of collapsed, a decent infrastructure bill. But now that he's going down the tubes, there's no real push by labor for an alternative political vision. So that's worrying. While the labor movement is very diverse these days, leadership continues to be incredibly white and male and incredibly hesitant to seriously support any movements against oppression. During the George Floyd uprising here, the response by most unions was terrible. There's actually a CWA union hall a few blocks down from the burned down Third Precinct here in Minneapolis. And their response when people were protesting was to board their windows, bar the doors, and, you know, get the hell out of Dodge. This is in contrast with the Lutheran Church, which opened its doors and was a site for first aid, food, and shelter for the next weeks and months. You know, and I say this with respect since I'm a preacher's kid, but when we're behind mainline Protestants, and especially the Lutherans, right, we're in bad shape. Okay, now that that's out of the way, there are some real bright signs, right? Since we're talking about the uprising, there are some fantastic responses by unions here and nationally. Thanks to a rank-and-file bus driver pushing for it, the ATU out here refused to drive any buses for police or to transport prisoners. ASCBE and letter carrier locals led marches, and the teachers' unions out here were wonderful, with the Minneapolis Federation of Teachers paying a high school English teacher, Marsha Howard, as an organizer to hold down George Floyd Square during the school year. In 2021, we saw Striketober and a real increase in strikes in the industrial sector. These strikes, which were mostly began by workers rejecting tentative agreements, resulted in some real gains and shined a light on the horrible working conditions in manufacturing these days. Hearing about Frito-Lay workers having to endure 16-hour working days, or John Deere workers having 7 months of probation before getting benefits and fight back against this, was really excellent, right? While teachers and nurses were really battered by the pandemic, they retained, I'd say, a lot of their energy, like we saw with the mixed but fairly successful strike here in Minneapolis by educators, and the incredibly brutal but victorious strike by St. Vincent's nurses in Worcester. There's also just been massive organizing in media, nonprofits, good continued organizing in healthcare, and, you know, what we're all thinking of right now, the Starbucks Workers United and Amazon Labor Union campaigns. These campaigns are unbelievably great so far, right? Young, diverse workers organizing democratically at the shop floor and beating the biggest companies with the biggest assholes for bosses. I don't want to add to what James said about Starbucks, because it was great, but we should all remember what Amazon thought about Christian Smalls. Here's this young Black man staging a protest. Let's make him the figurehead. He's not smart or articulate, right? I think most politicians, the media, and most unions would have agreed with this. They also wouldn't have believe that Deere could strike for a month, people in Topeka could inspire other people, right? Or that baristas in Buffalo would start a movement. Christian Smalls and all of these workers proved them so fucking wrong. Thank you.
Great, thank you. All right, next up is Ty.
Well, start where Paul left off. Yeah, I mean, I think clearly the incredible union victory at Amazon this week has sent, you know, a wave of hope throughout the labor movement. And it builds on the small but impressive uptick in strikes that Paul already mentioned last year, the wave of Starbucks unionizing. And I think, you know, anybody who's been kind of trying to keep their finger on the pulse of things, you know, I think can probably report that there is a general feeling that this post-pandemic situation with the labor shortage, or so-called labor shortage, but, you know, a tight labor market, that there is a more fighting and confident mood amongst workers. But of course, you know, you don't have to zoom out very far to realize that the labor movement remains locked in a crisis after 40 years of defeats and continuing declines in size. The fact that I think a scrappy, independent Amazon labor union cracked open Amazon to unionization rather than any of the big, experienced, well-resourced unions, as Paul mentioned, I think just underscores how profoundly conservative, bureaucratic, and ideologically bankrupt most of the major union leaderships remain. We face an important and notable contradiction right now. Gallup shows that 68% of the country supports unions last year, and that's the highest favorability rating for unions since 1965. Yet labor's decline continued last year, slipping to just 1 in 10 workers belonging to a union, whereas in 1965, it was 1 in 3 workers belonged to a union. And I think this contradiction creates a moment of possibility, but I have really little confidence, of course, that most of the existing union leadership is going to be capable of exploiting this contradiction effectively. But Christian Smalls and the Amazon labor movement took a bold leap into this contradiction and came out with an astounding victory. The Starbucks workers, notwithstanding, I think their ties to SEIU appear to, in practice, to be, you know, a rank and file driven effort in most areas, as we just heard today. And I'm hopeful that the new Teamsters leadership, who seem eager to take on Amazon and who are driven by a lot of rank and years, obviously decades of rank and file activism, is preparing a major battle against UPS. So there are bright spots. There are examples that I think can flower in this moment. And despite their conservative leadership, I think we have to, you know, socialists rest on a basic understanding. The unions remain the only mass working class organizations in the US. And as the US working class continues to radicalize, opening up the potential, it opens a potential to transform our unions, to replace the old business unionists and what I'm just starting to read Joe Byrne's great new book, what he calls class struggle liberals, to replace them with class struggle unionists. Bernie's campaigns, I think, were both a symptom of this process since the 2008 crisis of radicalization, but also really spurred that radicalization forward. The BLM uprising, I think it's actually been under developed analysis, but I've seen so much evidence that the BLM uprising in 2020 clearly has had major ripple effects into the workplace. And if you just, you know, if you think, I don't know enough, I'm sure we'll read more and there'll be studies, but I can't imagine that that radicalization of 2020 didn't have an impact on the largely Black and brown workers in Staten Island who just unionized Amazon. So I've been in the labor movement in some capacity for 25 years now, and I definitely can say I've never been more hopeful for the prospects of organized labor than I am today. And I think no small part of that is that the socialist movement too has dramatically grown over the last few years. There's tons of problems in DSA. There's tons of confusion, disagreements, rancor, toxicity, all of that I think anybody who's paid attention can see. And this debate around the rank and file strategy has been part of that. But stepping back, I think it's also extremely important and positive and a huge step forward from where we were 5 years ago or less, that there is thousands and thousands of organized socialists actively looking how to support, how to build the labor movement, that there's significant networks, 15 Teamsters in Portland who are working together to try and forge a path forward for their union. that we are seeing, I think DSA has represented a qualitative step forward. And, you know, as Joe Burns points out, I haven't been timing myself, Sarah, so let me know. But as Joe Burns points out, every major upsurge in the history of the labor movement has had people who identify as class struggle, you know, he labels them class struggle unionists, whether that's the IWW, whether that's the Communist Party, the Socialist Party, the Trotskyists, all different, you know, different wings. And there's important debates between that. But the fact that there's a growing conscious socialist movement that's finding its road into the labor movement gives me more reason to hope than I've had in my lifetime of activism.
Great. Thank you, Ty. And Laura, you're up.
Yeah, I think the, you know, I'm going to touch on probably some similar themes. I think we share some analysis, maybe differ a few places, but I think we're at an incredibly contradictory place in the labor movement in many ways. As Ty just mentioned, unions are at 68% approval in the US, which is really an all-time high. However, the response to the pandemic that we've seen from the state has been just breathtakingly terrible for workers, like worse than I could have possibly ever imagined at the start of the pandemic. And in a lot of ways, it's easy to see that the union movement it's utterly failed to stop the all-out assault on the capitalist class or from the capitalist class, which existed obviously before the pandemic. But I think the pandemic has really laid bare exactly what that looks like. We saw a rapid rise in promising organizing responses at the closer to the outset of the pandemic. Both in the workplace, there was a surge in interest in it. We saw, you know, efforts like EWOC pop up in DSA and with UE. And in the mass protests that happened throughout the summer. But I think we saw that happen. I think it's been playing out differently across different industries. So I think in industries like healthcare and education, it seems, what I've heard anyways from rank and file organizers is that the pandemic response, it continues to be a powerful motivator to organize around. It's an issue that's widely, deeply felt. In other industries like my own in construction, my read on it has been much more that there was a short 3-month window where there was a ton of interest and energy put into organizing in response to it. And it was unfortunately normalized much more quickly, I think, in the construction industry than in some other industries. And so it's been, you know, the response has been uneven and the organizing that it's set off has been extremely uneven. And I wouldn't say that it's not widely and deeply felt in construction anymore, but there's some high level of repression going on in terms of what's actually happened. And I think that we've seen that the pandemic response, it's temporarily deadened organizing in some places and it's releasing it in others. So it's happening in these really unexpected contradictory ways. Despite the high approval rating of unions, we have continued to see our numbers decline, you know, especially in the private sector. We saw promising signs in the private sector this past fall of a real fighting movement beginning to emerge, but it ultimately didn't reverse our numbers. I think some of the most promising developments that I kind of want to highlight is just the work of UAWD winning one member, one vote. The major upset of the Oz slate in the Teamsters election. I think these are two things that that even a couple years ago, like I think a lot of people wouldn't have thought were possible right now in this moment. So I don't want to take that for granted. I think there's big questions in terms of how much TDU and TDU aligned Teamsters will be in the driver's seat it certainly looks very promising right now based on the way that the new administration is starting off. And in terms of the resolution to organize Amazon that passed at the last convention, it appears that the Teamsters are putting major resources towards that. DSA is beginning to put resources towards organizing Amazon. And of course the recent upsurge in organizing at Starbucks, also just, totally unprecedented. I think that the Amazon labor union win of a few days ago, it's obviously such an incredible upset. It's turning a lot of traditional thinking about what's possible totally on its head. I know for a lot of people, there were a number of people in DSA that like felt like Amazon organizing was more possible once the Teamsters jumped into it full force. And I think that's like turned a lot of people to that. And I still think that that's extremely meaningful in this fight. However, there's obviously extremely new information to take in over the last couple of days about what's actually possible. And I think we're just really at the very like beginning of like understanding the meaning of it. There's a lot to learn about it. So I'm going to hold off making any sweeping generalizations. But there is one thing that I think this sort of points to. And I think it points to the idea that the level of class consciousness and class struggle consciousness, it's perhaps much higher than what anyone was thinking, than what a lot of people were thinking. And that an immobilized, labor movement has been failing to possibly take full advantage of that. And we're seeing major breakthroughs right now, despite the state of the formal labor movement. So.
Great, thank you. I think that was a really excellent overview that all three of you contributed to in different ways. So we got a good lay of the land. There was a request from Cynthia for Ty to put a link to the Joe Burns Class Struggle Unionism book in the chat, which I think is a great idea for everyone to check out. And we'll move on to our next question while Ty is doing that. And this is just drilling down on the rank and file strategy. It's formerly been DSA's approach since 2019. And so I'd like to hear what panelists think about it. Is it good, bad? Does it matter? And each speaker will have 5 minutes. Ty, you would kick us off. Then next would be Laura and then Paul. Okay.
Wonderful. And I didn't have a chance to put the link, but Haymarket has it on sale and you can find it on Amazon too. So that's where I direct folks to get the book. So I've been a lot more of an observer than a participant in what, I understand have been quite sharp debates in DSA over the last few years over the rank and file strategy. I've talked to people I know, but haven't really played any role in the national debates. But my impression is that there are really vital questions at stake in these debates, but that it also seems at times that the debates are sort of focused on some secondary tactical issues and, the forest can get lost for the trees at times. I think DSA should encourage its members to get jobs in strategic industries where it makes sense. But I think I am actually far more concerned with the question of what program do DSA members fight for inside their unions. I fully agree that we should orient DSA chapters more towards solidarity work and strikes and contract battles and lift up at the examples like Portland DSA, where they've done this effectively and recruited Nabisco workers and what have you. But at the same time, I think the central challenge we need to help our chapters deal with and overcome is how to clearly raise our socialist politics within those solidarity efforts, to recruit workers who are moving into struggle without making sectarian mistakes that alienate us from the best workers. It's complicated, it's not straightforward. I think it was a huge step, as I said earlier, that DSA adopted the rank and file strategy in 2019 and rejected the previous, what I see as failed strategy of trying to permeate, as I think it was framed, the union staff and leaderships with socialists. I mean, I'm all in favor of socialists running for union leadership, but, you know, on a clear basis, on a clear platform and program, openly, you know, talking about where you stand and building an actual base for that, not just trying to, you know, find positions. I mean, I'm a union staffer. I'm an organizer with AFSCME 28, and, you know, and I'm, you know, do that, that I recognize that creates a contradiction for my position. And I am fearful and anticipate that there will be moments where, you know, the pressures from the union leadership will come into conflict with my politics. And I recognize I'm in a far weaker position than a union organizer, I mean, than a union member. But what I think, despite it being a huge step forward, I think also it has created, the adoption of the rank and file strategy has created some contradictions that I don't know that all of its supporters have fully grappled with. The version of the rank and file strategy articulated by Kim Moody was, I think, came from an explicitly Marxist revolutionary strategy. And it was intimately tied, as others have pointed out in some of the debates, to the policy of working class political independence from the Democratic Party. It was a policy of confrontation with the union bureaucracy, who were an obstacle to fighting the bosses. It was designed to build a bridge from union consciousness to socialist consciousness, to create a well-organized militant minority of socialist labor activists. But, you know, I think the problem is, and this is not something that you could just overcome easily, it takes work, but there is not a conscious majority in DSA for these policies. There's not a conscious majority for revolutionary Marxism, obviously. And, you know, the nature of DSA as a big tent organization, I think, which I defend, I think makes sense at this stage in the struggle. So to get a rank and file strategy passed at the 2019 convention, my impression, to win a narrow majority in the context of a very sharp debate with what I would characterize as more conservative or reformist trends in the organization, there is huge pressure to drop or de-emphasize certain aspects of the rank and file strategy. So I would prefer, I think it is a step forward that it was passed, even if there's confusion about what it means or there wasn't perfect clarity. But I would prefer having a strong, you know, Marxist minority in DSA advocating in a rounded out, coherent, clear way for a politically sharp version of the rank and file strategy than to kind of have a muddled version that is a formal, has a formal status of being official DSA policy. I'll just end my comments by, you know, saying, once again, pumping Joe Burns' book. I think actually the framework that Joe Burns lays out of class struggle unionism and how it's distinguished from what he calls, business unionism, I'm sure that's familiar, and labor liberalism, which he develops as sort of a newer version of business unionism. I think that actually does offer the potential to sort of become a genuine majority position inside DSA. And I think that would be a step forward. It creates a real bright line between what he frames as sort of a fair day's wage for a fair day's work kind of mentality that basically accepts the legitimacy of the capitalist system and doesn't try to go beyond its limits, to what he defines as class struggle unionism, which says labor creates all wealth. We do not accept the existing system, and we will not limit our demands in the workplace or in the political arena to what capitalism can afford. That can be syndicalist, that can be revolution. You know, there's a lot of, and Joe Burns himself kind of characterizes as a big tent framework, but I think that is a framework that can and probably does have a majority in DSA in one way or another. And I think within that, the fight for the rank and file strategy and a debate and development of that, which I think represents a more revolutionary wing, or I would characterize it that way anyway, is also important.
Thanks, Ty. Turn it over to Laura.
Yeah, thanks. I'm going to lay out a little bit about DSA's formal labor strategy. We did adopt it. We passed a resolution in 2019, as Ty mentioned, just narrowly, heavily debated. We also passed two other labor resolutions that same convention. CPNs toward a clear, multifaceted strategy for labor, and an organized the unorganized resolution. CPNs passed pretty overwhelmingly. Organized, the unorganized also passed strongly. The rank and file strategy passed, passed more narrowly and much more contentiously, I would say. So I think, you know, I think while it has been DSA's official labor policy since 2019, we've remained this, you know, obviously this big tent organization and big tent in labor as well. And it's meant many different, many forces pulling different directions on what our actual labor strategy is in practice and where our resources go. I'm going to give some background just because I think it's important to kind of ground this. The multifaceted strategy for labor, it called for hiring a full-time labor organizer. It called for regional workplace organizing schools, educating DSA members, holding workplace organizer trainings for both organized and unorganized. It called for assessment of local conditions and developing grassroots labor networks. And there was kind of this emphasis on regional structure versus like industry structure. The rank and file strategy resolution also called for a full-time labor staffer for the DSLC to focus on pursuing the rank and file strategy, creating education materials, a speakers bureau, committees or discussion groups based on jobs, strike support and strike support pamphlet, connecting with labor notes organizer training, and helping chapters create jobs programs. And I think, you know, I just to lay out bare kind of what's actually been prioritized or what's happened. You know, we kicked off our terms on the DSLC steering committee in 2019 with the NPC, you know, stepping into to institute EWOC, which was a major focus on organizing the unorganized at the start of the pandemic. We had a Save the USPS campaign that I think, you know, especially at the start, was not a rank and file strategy based campaign. It connected later with you know, an already established postal workers network from labor notes. But there was, to be totally honest, a lot of resistance to making that rank and file strategy based because I was actively trying to connect that, and there were, you know, there was active resistance against that. The restaurant organizing project started up around that time, which is obviously still in existence and set us up well to do a lot of the Starbucks work that we're seeing today. But in general, because of this, I think very big tent approach, there was a whole cycle of projects that were taken on and dropped at various points. And so it meant that a lot resources never fully went into almost anything. And if things were carried out, it was due to one or two extremely committed people just making it happen. One of those things is we finally have a rank and file strategy pamphlet that's going to be launched next weekend on Sunday, 7 p.m. Eastern, April 10th. So you should all come to that if you can. But that's one of those things that was, that was kind of deprioritized and delayed and delayed and delayed. I think it's, I'm being told I have to wrap up already, unfortunately. I think it's good that DSA has formally adopted the rank and file strategy and broken with its long history of trailing former labor leadership. But I don't think that we should deceive ourselves in how deeply entrenched some of that perspective still is, particularly in the national director and staff structure among parts of the membership and parts of the leadership. And I think that because of this, we can't we need to push as hard as we can to make it real in DSA, but it can't solely exist in DSA, the rank and file strategy, and we have to be open to parts of it existing outside. So
thank you. All right, next up is Paul.
Thanks, everyone. That was, I think, yeah, lots of interesting stuff being said. So I think for me to start, it'd be good to go back into the history of the rank and file strategy as first written by Kim Moody, who is a fellow member of the Tempest Collective in the 1990s. And what he was doing was contrasting, I would say, like two separate approaches to the labor movement, right? The first was something called, what Ty said, a permeation, which is what the Communist Party did in its Popular Front phrase, or actually what DSA was doing in the 90s, which is getting staff jobs within the labor movement. There's a resurgence of this in the 90s because of the election of John Sweeney to the head of the AFL-CIO and the New Voices slate and the rise to the scene of SEIU in this time period. So for the first time in a while, organized labor kind of threw open its doors and said to lefties, like, you can enter. And what Moody was saying was that there's this alternative approach that radicals have done throughout history. He kind of starts with the Communist Party and the Trade Union Education League, the TUEL, in the 20s, continues on to what groups like the Communist League out here in Minneapolis were doing in the 30s with the Teamsters, and picking up again in the 70s with the rise of the New Left and outgrowths, like the groups like his own, the International Socialists, and the New Communist Movement, who did what was called industrializing, entering into the labor movement. So he takes a look at movements in the 90s, like TDU, rank and file led battles in Staley and the Detroit newspaper strike, and says this is where we should be aiming, right? He sets forward a few tasks based on this, such as supporting reform movements, building cross-union industrial coalitions, supporting worker centers, and bringing forward political demands, which he later amended back in 2014, I think, by adding on supporting new class struggle-based organizing and also being clear and maintaining a shop floor focus. Overall, though, I would say this is a pretty broad strategy, right, when it comes to tactics. Where it is defined is in its politics, right? The rank and file strategy is about building up the militant minority and reconnecting socialism and the labor movement. And it's adamant that this can only be done with a clear focus on bottom-up change by the working class. To understand why this is so important, we have to talk about what the labor bureaucracy is, right? Moody's compatriots, and I would include myself in this, view the bureaucracy in a sociological sense. So there are misleaders, but it isn't just an issue of bad politics or bad ideology. There's a structure to the bureaucracy that will always inhibit militants, right? Your salary and your working conditions, maybe Ty will know, are usually much different than on the shop floor, right? You always have to be thinking of the long-term future of the union because they provide your salary, and you have a boss who can and will fire you if you get out of line, right? Often you kind of end up being a mediator between the boss and kind of you start to think of the workers as unreasonable, right? So that's what he's saying, right? So with this all out of the way, let's talk about the DSA rank and file strategy, right? Since it's been adopted, it's kind of come to mean basically like getting a job in quote unquote strategic industries. And then, well, that part is kind of sketchy. I see a lot of people on Twitter going like, you're gonna do the rank and file strategy, but basically supporting reform caucuses and making the union more democratic. So I'd say that kind of misses the why, right? Which is that we believe in the working class and we think that determines our approach. So what about building new unions like ALU? Well, if you're coming from a political standpoint, well, that's in the rank and file strategy. But if you're going from the DSA point of view, maybe not. And the rest of our labor work has been a mix, I would say. So there's been some great stuff like the strike solidarity campaigns that lots of chapters have done, Portland, Birmingham with the mine workers I love. And again, from a political standpoint, you know, doing things like approaching the workers and leadership and connecting with them or the IU or the staff, that's really amazing, right? But then you have campaigns that are kind of basically the reverse, right? So the PRO-ACT campaign we can talk about now was approached as a way to build ties with the IUPET and CWA leadership, and not really as a way to connect with the rank and file. And, you know, that's fine, right? That's an idea. But I'm bringing this up because this can, in fact, directly interfere with the rank and file strategy. So if a reform caucus starts in CWA, which is, in all honesty, a pretty bureaucratic union, then what do, right? If we start supporting them, do we lose our coalition? Will DSA candidates have their endorsement pulled? You can see what I'm getting at here, right? So we have to, even if it's a broad tent, we have to think about like the different things we're doing and how they tie in with each other. Thanks.
Great, thank you. Our next question is just, what is the role of socialists in the labor movement? And we'll have Laura kick us off, then Paul, and then finish up with Ty.
So I think socialists absolutely need to be at the beating heart of the labor movement. I think we need to be there doing the difficult and sometimes monotonous work of organizing alongside coworkers, literally years in advance of the moment that there's a big strike, a unionization drive, a big action, like the moment that the spotlight is on. We need to earn our coworkers' trust as tried and true leaders in the workplace and in our unions over the course of years. And just from what I've seen, you know, in the Carpenters Union over a decade, this trust comes from hard work and dedication to building the labor movement and organizing, you know, all coworkers. It comes from our analysis of the problems that people are facing at work and getting at the root problems and causes of what we're actually dealing with at the workplace. It comes in our skill in developing a plan alongside coworkers, bringing people in, executing a plan, and ultimately winning something out of it. It can come from being just simple things like being good at your job. James spoke to this earlier about, you know, about actually liking work being important, or liking something about what you do. So actually being good at your job, standing up for people and demonstrating in action how to fight shoulder to shoulder. And this needs to happen across many smaller movements in the workplace and in the union, literally built up over years. Just to give an example, in the Carpenters, a couple years ago, we had our union leadership, we had a contract campaign going. It was totally rank and file driven. And our union leadership attempted to pass a really terrible contract over like 4th of July weekend, like sneak it past us. We don't unfortunately get to vote on our contract, which is one really fucked up thing that needs to change. But there's a delegate body that does, and they attempted to like kind of slip it past the members on this 4th of July weekend. And we were able to just within a couple of days turn out notice over 4th of July weekend, turn 600 people out to a rally outside of our own hall, you know, to attempt to stop it. That would not have happened if we hadn't been doing that long, slow build over the course of years to just be able to like immediately reach out to people like that. And, you know, I think socialists in the labor movement, we need to, you know, I'm of the belief that we need to aim for the boss in the capitalist class, but that it's perfectly fine if we're, you know, if we're catching anybody who's standing in the way, any union bureaucracy that's in the way in the crossfire. You know, I don't think our goal is to go in to fight union leadership. However, I think that it would not serve us well to be blind to the ways in which the labor movement has been deeply misled by some of the leadership, demobilized. And we need to not be afraid at any point to step on toes, to reveal deep apathy and inertia in the leadership, or sometimes out and out class collaboration from the leadership. I think, you know, we need to be there wherever and whenever there is struggle against the bosses and against the capitalist class. We're a 90,000 person organization, and our active members are significantly smaller in number than that even. So we're just, you know, given our size, we're not going to be at the heart of every single workplace struggle, unfortunately, where we are right now. But I think it's our job, A, to move as many socialists into the labor movement as possible, and, you know, and as workers, you know, and so we're somewhat this drop in the bucket right now. I still think we can punch well above our weight. And building labor and strike solidarity within DSA chapters, I think is going to continue to be critical. It's, you know, it's another, when, you know, when something pops off, you know, we might not always have GSA members already there at the heart of struggle, but it's another extremely important way to connect, you know, to connect workers fight with the boss to the greater fight against the capitalist class. And I think some of the ways that that Laura Wadlin laid out earlier are like exactly what we should be doing and where we should be getting every single DSA chapter up to in the meantime. So I'll go ahead and end there.
Great. That was really, really excellent. Next up is Paul.
Thanks. And thanks, Laura. So yeah, this really great question, right? And I think something we should be asking ourselves all the time. What are we doing? Right. First, I want to push back on something I've seen a lot of, this idea that socialists are supposed to be like the magic all-star organizers, right? Like, that's not true. We don't have a secret sauce. We're not going to bring light to the classless masses, right? There's, so, you know, I always think of this incredible story that Mike Ely, a radical from the 70s who went down into the coal mines in West Virginia, tells where, you know, he shaves, he married his girlfriend, changed his clothes in order to like fit in with the real working class. And he gets down to Meitwan, you know, and it's all long-haired Vietnam vets like smoking weed. So you'll definitely see this in history, right? People coming in and either hectoring workers constantly about the right line, or I'd say equally as bad, right? Like hanging back and never revealing your real politics because the workers aren't advanced enough to know how like much of a badass communist you are, right? But okay, enough of what's been. What's been, I think, most helpful to me is to see what people in our heritage have done and continue to do. So there are things that we've talked about before, like I think helping to build reform caucuses, democratized unions is incredibly important. So it's been great to see movements like UAWD, which has a lot of contributions from DSA members, right? And seeing like a real class struggle union like CTU and what they can do is really just incredible, right? So I grew up in DC suburbs in the age of Michelle Rhee. The difference CORE and people like Jesse and the rest of CTU has made, it's just so, so important, right? So first and foremost, though, is what we're doing in the shop floor. And throughout history, radicals have kept in mind, I think, two things. First, it's the idea of like no compromise, right? That we're always being exploited, like what Joe Burns is saying, and that we always have to be fighting back, not working together with management. And the second is the realization that the main thing keeping us from coming together is the way the boss divides us by race, gender, sexuality, language. Just to illustrate this, in the original rank and file strategy pamphlet, I did a word count. Kim Moody uses the words race, racist, racism almost 30 times, right? This is important. It should be no surprise then that the action I mentioned at the beginning where the bus drivers union refused to drive cops during the uprising, those started by a socialist. Or that the health worker who is out here, who has built a massive coalition spanning multiple unions in our county hospital to fight the structural racism and really just explicit racism in medicine, he's a socialist, right? That when the building trades let in the National Guard into the St. Paul Labor Hall back in 2021 during the protest against the murder of Dante Wright here, it was socialists and anarchists who kicked them out, right? So beyond this, there's the idea of connecting workers across industry and organizing the unorganized, right? So it's what I've been working on personally with my comrades in the restaurant organizing project for 2 years, getting workers from across the service industry to talk to each other about working conditions and issues like racism and sexism and trying to help them get organized. And I think the works like work that groups like ALU and Amazonians United are doing is really just a North Star for us right now, really important. But ideally, there's a bigger goal when we're doing all this, right? We're trying to rebuild and reconnect this militant minority and actually have a real radical labor movement again. So as an example, during the teacher strike here, we had a community solidarity rally organized by all the union lefties, the different red unions were all out there, right? All the different tendencies. There are 4 or 5 of us from my workplace, around 200 people total. So it was good. It was a good time. But I couldn't help to imagine what it would have been like if there were 2,000 or like 20,000 people there. That should be our goal for next time, right? But of course, we also want to bring our coworkers, at the end of the day, we want to bring our coworkers to socialism, right? It would be wrong to think that struggle alone or unions alone would do that. Otherwise, the political situation now would be pretty different, right? And this is the really, really tough part. And I don't have all the answers to this. I don't know all the answers to this. And I think this is where DSA comes in, right? This is where an organization like DSA, is so critical. We need a place to bring together all these struggles and cohere them into a real movement for revolutionary change and talk about it with each other so we can figure this out. Because I can't do it myself. Thanks.
Great, thank you. So Ty is the next speaker, and then after him, we're gonna move into discussion. So if you could indicate in Stack, if you wanna come in so we can get it organized and not lose any time to hear the most voices. So go ahead, Ty.
Well, I kinda, before this, put together two sets of notes for how to answer this, and I wasn't sure, but I thought what Laura said, what Paul said, really covered one set. So I'm gonna focus on another. And that is, I mean, I think one of the biggest central challenges that DSA members face that is genuinely confusing and hard is how do you deal with the, you know, the labor bureaucracy? And as a side note, I agree with what Paul said that, you know, it's easy to, with throwing that term around, to actually lose sight of the sort of more structural, there's great people in the union bureaucracy. I'm a great person. I'm in the union bureaucracy as a staffer. It's complicated. And sometimes you can find very radical people in very significant positions in the unions. And nonetheless, they play a conservatizing role that socialists have an obligation to find ways to push back against. I think the role of socialists in the labor movement is to try and help overcome, I mean, among other things, the conservatism, the bureaucratic fight, and to fight for union democracy, which is not just an in and of itself, but it's the tool of workers to overcome that, to be able to really bring forward, you know, what's necessary to win. So all that can sound like sloganeering, like sterile empty phrases, and there's a danger that I think, you know, there can be, sound like a formula for sectarian isolation. But I want to give a story that I think will help bring it forward. And Paul gave lots of examples from Minneapolis. I spent 16 years organizing in Minneapolis. I'm now out in Seattle, but I helped initiate and lead the fight for 15 that won in 2017. We launched 15 now in 2014 with my former organization, Socialist Alternative, but a lot of other groups and activists playing a role. And from the beginning, we understood that we needed to win the labor movement to be able to win 15, to back 15 minimum wage for Minneapolis. But SEIU and others, SEIU was the most politically influential union in Minneapolis at the time, probably still is, and was at the center, of course, of the fight for 15 nationally. But they opposed, the leadership opposed calling on Minneapolis City Council and the mayor to fight for 15. And they did that because they had just elected Mayor Betsy Hodges, a labor-backed mayor who while supporting sort of a limited suite and backroom negotiations, they worked out a certain limited platform that she would support workers' rights. She also wanted to make good with the Chamber of Commerce, who'd opposed her in the 2013 election, and to triangulate between labor and big business. So she opposed 15 as a step too far in her negotiations with the chamber. And what happened is, the chamber put pressure on Betsy Hodges. Betsy Hodges put pressure on the union leadership. The union leadership put pressure on us and the activists to say 15 needs to go away. It's not the right time. This is not the period. There's other smaller but more winnable fights that we can get through. Of course, we rejected this and continued to campaign for 15. But we also were careful not yet to kind of publicly call out the labor leaders, to give them an excuse to marginalize us, because we knew the only route to victory was to win over the rank and file of SEIU, of the other unions, to wider coalition that had gotten Mayor Hodges elected. We joined, in fact, the SEIU-led coalition, Minnesotans for a Fair Economy, and openly urged argued our case inside the coalition and crucially with the base of that coalition, with the activists, rank and file activists. The big moment was we began planning a big demonstration for a $15 minimum wage for April 15th, 2015. It was a great, you know, sequence of days. The same week that the mayor was going to debut her much more limited workers' rights agenda in her State of the City speech. And we faced huge pressure from SEIU and the coalition leaders to call off the demonstration, that this was, you know, mucking up their carefully orchestrated behind the scenes plans. But we prepared the ground well. We had petitioned, we'd done systematic work, we'd had one-on-one meetings with the rank and file, we built up trust through years of other work from Occupy Homes to other things. And instead of canceling our demonstration, we called on the coalition. We said, this is a time you need to endorse the demonstration, you need to join us. And we agitated the activist base to call on their leaders to do it. And this created a crisis for the labor leaders. Either they break with Betsy Hodges and Back 15, or they lose serious credibility with their own base. And we were saying, look, we're gonna have to call you out if you don't do this. We spent a year not calling them out, but this, we were prepared to do it. Long story short, we won. SAIU and Minnesotans for a Fair Economy, there was literally behind the scenes meetings where the mayor was screaming at them, telling them not to do this, but they did it. They felt they had no choice. And they backed our demonstration and they merged with us. It helped that we had Lizzo agreeing to play from the back of a flatbed truck outside of McDonald's where Seitul was organizing a strike for 15. It created quite a dynamic. That's not the end of the story. It took two more years to win 15. But I think what it demonstrated, and there was a lot of wrangles with the labor leadership, a lot of other issues. It wasn't like they came swung behind us and the rest was history. But the point that I think it taught me is that it is possible to take a principled confrontational approach. It doesn't mean just denouncing the labor leaders at every turn. It means thinking tactically, having a long game approach, thinking carefully, but maintaining a clear independent position. It shows why labor, political independence from the Democratic Party isn't just a secondary issue, but is at the very core of whether or not you're going to be effective in fighting. And it shows the need for a coherent, organized socialist core that is prepared to develop an independent policy from the labor leaders and where necessary to confront them. So that's my story of what the role of socialists and labor movement is. I think it has bigger implications, obviously, for how we operate. And I think it's one of the things that DSA struggles with the most, but we'll need to figure out better if we want to play the role I know we all want to.
Great, thank you. I thought that last question was really excellent. The panelists were able to give sort of new folks to the movement, like key things to focus on in their workplace, like concrete actions you can do, and then also providing sort of the 55,000 foot view or 35,000 foot view of how socialists should approach work in the labor movement. And so now we would open this up to a broader discussion to hear from as many people as possible. We're asking that people limit their comments to 3 minutes. I'm sorry, that's very short, but that's so we can hear from the most amount of people. I'm gonna have a timer and you'll hear it buzz at 3 minutes. And so it's gonna be a sort of awkward stop to your speaking. And then after that, after about 45 minutes of open discussion, then we'll move to sum up from the panelists. And so I'm gonna kick us right off. Mick has a question, and I don't know, is someone able to unmute him? I don't know how, or can he unmute himself? I'm not sure how to do that. Mick, do you wanna go with your question?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay. Hi, my name is Mick. I'm a DSA member. I'm also a union member, UFCW Local 1000 here in North Texas. And I know that we have another UFCW member on the panel, I think Paul, but this is a question for everybody. So in a situation like mine where, we've already got a bargaining unit recognized, we have for a while, it seems like the main obstacle for implementing something like the rank and file strategy from where I'm at is my own union, because the UFCW is a pretty top-down centralized union, pretty undemocratic. And it seems like there's a real opportunity for a fighting movement of retail workers in this country. It seems like one of the most, ripe areas to organize. And it's kind of unfortunate that the union that's in the best position to do that is probably one of the most undemocratic in the country right now. So, Paul, I know you're a UFCW member, but anybody else who has experience trying to, bring maybe a reform caucus to a union that hasn't had one before, basically just trying to adapt the strategy that we've been talking about here. to a situation where the union is part of the obstacle.
Great, thank you, Mick. And just how we'll do the questions is folks should take note. And if you wanna come in to respond to the question, great. Or if the panelists wanna respond in the sum up, that's great. But we'll kind of keep moving through the stack to keep things moving. So next up I have Nathan Aries with a question, then followed by Honda and Steve Lee. Okay, so Nathan.
Yeah, my question is, what can DSA do as an organization, like structurally, to make union organizing or union movement a priority? Because it really isn't, despite, you know, numerous resolutions, it's not necessarily a priority. And though we are being pushed in different directions, and we have too many priorities. So my question is, what can DSA do at the next convention to make sure it's a priority? And like, what other structural changes need to take place? And so we focus on the labor movement and the class struggle. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Nathan. Next up is Honda.
Hi there. By and large, I think most people on this call and indeed our panelists are in common agreement on many broad points. My thoughts here are going to be primarily addressing the voices opposed to the rank and file strategy that are not present. And I hope these ideas can be properly defended by those who hold them in the future. The fundamental question about the rank and file strategy that it asks us is, are socialists content to cheer from the sidelines, or do we have an obligation to join workers on the shop floor? I don't think we should be content with the former, as evidenced by wins at Starbucks and Amazon. We need to be organizing the workplace shoulder to shoulder with organic leaders from the rank and file. Now, the social left has the strength of its cadre, but limited resources to fight capital. And so, you know, at the start, James referenced the resources that Starbucks workers needed from Workers United. And indeed, a large focus of the rank and file strategy is being able to reform and change how existing unions, with their millions of dollars, legal staff, and more, how they approach the need to be actively organizing and supporting a militant rank and file movement. And so we have an obligation to be strategic. Otherwise, we're going to be going back and forth between every single potential hotspot and exhausting ourselves in that process. I'm also worried about long-term sustainability. Independent efforts like ALU, while its due structure is very accessible, it also means that it may not be able to afford a sustained fight over decades by itself, right? The time horizon of the rank and file strategy is not measured in months or years, but in decades, and that long view is necessary. Sam Gidin once wrote that the immediate task of a mass socialist party isn't carrying out a still distant revolution, rather it's to support the transformation of atomized and demoralized workers into a confident social force. And that's, I think, what the rank and file strategy prioritizes. There's also a focus on specific industries or sectors that are also important, because we want to win more than just a contract. As socialists, we have the transformational demands that would fundamentally change the nature of our society. So where do we focus our limited resources to leverage our cadre to have the biggest impact? Rank and file proponents have suggested industries like education, nursing, and logistics. Teachers in education, the return to school controversy is evidence of their position as a linchpin in our economy. Nurses have incredibly strong credentials among the US public, and they can lead campaigns focusing on things like healthcare, which still remains a salient issue. And logistics controls the flow of goods across our country. Stopping deliveries across UPS, FedEx, or Amazon would send tremors throughout the economy and the capitalist class. And so from my perspective, this analysis of strategic sectors of the economy really vindicates the approach of the rank and file strategy proponents. And so, just because I'm coming up on my end of my time, in summary, on tactics, the rank and file strategy is flexible, right? You can organize an independent union, which then affiliates. You can focus on industrializing where there already is a union. You can approach it in many ways. On targets, its analysis on key industries remains salient, and its path for long-term sustainability has yet to be meaningfully challenged from my perspective. And on its theory of change, which is rooted in the radicalization of workers into a militant social force that is capable and willing to do much more than just bargaining for a contract, is very much within the mainstream of Marxist organizers across DSA. However, DSA has yet to meaningfully adopt it. There are few resources allocated to supporting those trying to pursue it, and an organization has been tailing the existing militancy of rank and file workers across the country. Many of them who could be in these strategic industries that we could be radicalizing even further right now.
Great, thank you. Next up is Steve, and he's the last person I have on stack. If you want a little more than 3 minutes to speak, you should get in now. To take advantage of that. Steve, go ahead.
Okay. Hi. Thanks a lot to the organizers of this. It's a very interesting discussion and very useful. So I wanted to go off a little bit on the rank and file strategy, a couple aspects of it, which Kim Moody put forward and other people have as well. And that is fundamentally, politically, the rank and file strategy is based on the idea that not only do we need class struggle at the workplace on the economic front, we also need class struggle in the political front. In other words, a basis of the rank and file strategy is the idea that the Democratic Party is a party of the bosses. It's a party that pursues the interests of the bosses. And we can see this very clearly in all sorts of ways. The dropping of the PRO Act, for example, the general, you know, both under Obama and under Biden, et cetera, et cetera. But I mean, you can go into all sorts of details about the, you know, pro-imperialist policy of the U.S., which is backed by all the Democrats in Congress, whether they're in DSA or not, et cetera. Support for the police, the idea that more funding for the police will take place when we understand the police are a big anti-labor element as well as racist, et cetera. So that's one key aspect. It's the Democratic Party. Another one is the idea of a permanent rank and file opposition. That is the rank and file movement, not just to elect better leaders, but understanding what was pointed out about the structural contradiction between the rank and file and the bureaucracy. So even when you have, quote, good leaders elected, you need to have a strong rank and file strategy to push them. And so that, I think that's really, really important. So what I'd like to ask the various panelists is, what do they think about the rank and file strategy, class struggle, unionism in terms of anti-democratic party when DSA itself is organized primarily or, you know, greatly to elect Democratic Party politicians? How can that class struggle unionism be carried out while that is going on in DSA? And then ask what they think is what they think about the idea of a permanent rank and file opposition rather than just to elect better leaders. Okay, thank you very much.
Great, thanks, Steve. Okay, next up the stack so far is Stefan, Brandon Madsen, Philip Locker, and Whitney. And then I might shuffle people around, but those are the next three so far. Go ahead.
Yeah, thanks for everybody for being part of this discussion. I think it's quite decisive that we have this. I think the starting point that we all agree is that labor in the US is not in good shape. But also I think a starting point is that a new generation inspired by what Bernie Sanders promoted as socialist ideas, inspired by that, and the new generation inspired by anti-racism, anti-sexism, hits the workplaces and is changing things there. And this is a huge chance and huge opportunity. And in that framework, I feel like DSA needs to have more discussion on our role there and be sharp on that. And we don't have to agree, but I think just the debate about that we'll have. And I think what we can bring is organizing. And organizing means organizing workers, but also being clear about the terrain where there is a organized business unionism that we are confronted with in the unions. And if we don't organize, we leave it to them be organized in their leadership circles with their staff, with the pressure they can put on the staff. A union bureaucracy that we are confronted with is not something that we can take lightly. And I think this is where socialists can bring something to these battles in this period that the new generation of activists will need, but does not necessarily have. There is this huge uprising of self-confidence, of pushing back. It's excellent. But I think there are the experiences that a lot of us went also through of the pressures you face if you're an isolated activist. It's not just union bureaucracy is not, oh, you get hired. I was never a union full-timer, but I was a shop steward. I was elected in Germany to a works council. I saw how the pressures work. Everyone on a bargaining team in a union knows how the pressures work. You need an organized caucus, like CORE in the Chicago Teachers Union, like the attempts from the TDU and the Teamsters, UAWD, and so on. You need an organized caucus where you have the back of each other, but also the pressure on those you elect, you put in positions of power to stick to what Ty outlined or Joe Burns outlined as class struggle unionism That's where I would think this is a socialist rank and file strategy, where we're not satisfied with making deals with the employer, but questioning the whole system. And I don't think it was an accident that at the cause of, for example, the Red State Revolt, were socialists, people who had a mindset that we do not just ask within the framework of capitalism, we ask what we need and fight for that. That is, I think, where we have a crucial role to play, to organize against business unionism, offer ideas, socialist ideas. That does not mean that we make it a precondition to fight with us, to be a socialist. A union should be there for everyone, but it means that we take it on, that we battle within the unions to educate our co-workers, other people, fight for socialist ideas, and a strategy that's based on an inclusive strategy, with space for everyone to fight with us, but a strategy that is based on an awareness of the need to link our struggle to a fundamental transformation of society.
Great, thank you. Okay, the new stack, Brandon Madsen, Noel, Philip, Whitney K. So Brandon?
Yeah, thanks. I didn't know Stefan was going to be right before me on stack when I came in, because I'm going to draw on some points that he developed in an article recently that I liked a lot. But basically, I just wanted to come in on the question of the union bureaucracy and what we mean when we talk about that, because I think that there's some lack of clarity around that sometimes. I think it's a real thing, but people mean different things when they say it. And so, you know, I think for me, when I agree with the need to oppose bureaucracy in the unions, oppose the union bureaucracy, but I don't think that means, you know, every staffer, every elected leader, you know, is automatically part of the bureaucracy by virtue of that position alone. That the, you know, by virtue of that position alone, you certainly come under those pressures that Stefan was referring to. But I think of the bureaucracy as like the layer that under those pressures over time has sort of ossified into this entrenched layer that does largely consciously defend a pro-capitalist political trend within the unions, that sees it as their job to oppose the quote unquote unreasonable elements within the unions, that sees the unions as sort of an end in and of themselves that need to be maintained against destabilizing forces, rather than as a tool that workers pick up and use to push forward for their interests. And I think this is not a new problem, obviously. This is over a century old problem. You can read about from Rosa Luxemburg talking about this more than a century ago, talking about how, ironically, as unions develop, you know, they gain in power, but they also gain in this structure that creates a trade union officialdom that has a restricted horizon, has a bureaucratism and a narrowness of outlook, and that there's a revolution in the relations between the leaders and the rank and file. And so, like, you know, with this new Amazon labor union and its successes, you know, if Chris Smalls gets hired on as a full-time, you know, president of the union or whatever, like, is he then automatically a bureaucrat by virtue of that position? You know, I would argue no, that it is possible to have a relationship between leadership and rank and file that is productive, that is organic, that pushes forward in the interests of the workers. But I think there are pressures, and without an organized opposition that Stefan talked about, to those pressures, a bureaucracy can and will develop. That's the sort of natural of affairs under capitalism, if unions are sort of allowed to just become these self-perpetuating, self-justifying organizations rather than dynamic tools of struggle by the workers from the bottom up. But that's a contested question, you know, whether he becomes a bureaucrat, whether that position becomes bureaucratized, whether the structure of the union becomes bureaucratized. It's not just a question of tops and rank and file. It's also a question of what is the relationship between the two, and having both in line, pushing forward with a class struggle organization, I think, is the sort of key antidote to bureaucracy.
Great. Thank you, Brandon. Noel?
Yeah. And I think also, like, just as with our socialist organizations, we need to have, like, recallable, accountable leadership in our unions and such. But the main thing I was thinking is like, the reason I got on Stack was thoughts about like further politicizing labor, you know, with the class struggle, unionism and such. And, but not just like with bargaining for the common good, like directly in contracts, like pondering how do we actually like build on our labor connections to bring labor out into broader class struggle. Thinking, for instance, stuff like, you know, the movie Pride, perhaps minor spoiler, the unions end up coming out to the, not coming out like that, but you know what I mean, coming to like the head of a Pride parade, you know, even though their strike lost, basically, like they came back in appreciation of that solidarity and such. And, you know, ultimately, like wondering how we get to like the point where we can have like political strikes and such like that. You know, like also the idea that, you know, the only illegal strike is an unsuccessful one, you know, given what unions are and aren't legally allowed to do. But yeah, I mean, we're not at that point broadly, but then again, you're thinking of the flight attendants who's, you know, yeah, played a big part in, you know, stopping the government shutdown a few years ago, you know, and such. Yeah. And like, you know, how do we bring labor out to stuff? And, you know, again, yeah, not just saying, oh, hey, support this legislation, you know, however good that may be. Like, yeah, you know, with the eviction representation for all campaign here in Portland, it's like, yeah, can we get, you know, the trades behind this? Can we get like the DCTU folks that we are supporting who are, you know, handled like housing stuff and permits and the like for the city, get them out, you know, to demonstrations and such, you know, things like that, you know, and even beyond to like more general political stuff, like we had help. Yeah. And like, you know, and like for getting legislation and reforms to give the working class more breathing space and such, we also need that as like practice for, you know, further class struggle, flexing the working class's muscles. Like, instead of like calling on unions to like phone bank for like, you know, Medicare for all and such, imagine if we were in a place to get to have like healthcare unions like stage strikes saying, no, we need Medicare for all. We're going to shut things down unless we actually get it. Like, imagine if we were at that point. And yeah, folks have any thoughts on how to actually get towards that point? Jack.
Great. Thank you, Noel. Next up is Philip, then Whitney, then Stu. Oh, and Brian, can you add Peter Landon to the Stack, please? He just messaged me. Go ahead, Philip.
Okay, can you hear me all right?
Mm-hmm.
I feel like very often in DSA, the discussion about the rank and file strategy or labor sort of boils down to, I think, points I totally agree with, but I think is missing key aspects of, or is too limited about labor is good. We should organize solidarity when workers are going to struggle. And to the extent that we get involved in unions, we want to fight for reform caucuses that will make them more democratic. I agree with all those things, but I think that's a pretty limited perspective. And I think it misses a key part from the point of view for what's a key element of a socialist perspective on the labor movement is, how are we going to rebuild the labor movement? It's so weak right now. And it's a question of strategy. of what are the politics? What's the strategy that's going to be needed to win? Is it just saying labor's good? Is it just saying we need more solidarity? Obviously, those things are good, but how do we make a breakthrough and rebuild a powerful labor movement? And I think that the core of that, and it's come up in different ways in this discussion, is a debate about a class struggle approach, which works, and a class collaboration approach, which is currently what dominates the labor movement and is failing. And if we're going to build an effective labor movement, it requires a break with class collaboration and requires class struggle. And socialists are the most conscious understanders of that and should be trying to agitate and organize and educate within our unions around a class struggle political program against the class collaborationist, reformist, bureaucratic, undemocratic approach of the dominant leadership. So just to give, I just think with Amazon, one thing that's, or two quick examples that stand out of that is UAW trying to organize all the new auto workers in the South. How is that possible when they're collaborating with the auto companies in the North on really bad contracts? What's the excitement about joining a union if they can point to, you don't, in Tesla, you get paid more than in a UAW organized shop. So organizing is integrally linked with taking on the bosses and not just having democracy, but actually winning dramatic changes in people's lives. One other example I will give, but that breaks with the whole narrow outlook of class collaboration, is Amazon. The main signs I saw in all the pictures from the RSDWU organizing in Bessemer was like, one of the main signs was RSDWU stands with you. Like, and that was like, that really summarizes a lot of the slogans I saw them talking about, their messaging. Chris Smalls and Staten Island, one of the main things I heard from them is they were fighting for a $30 an hour starting wage and more break time. Again, I think that encapsulates, so I think that's part of what our role in as socialists and labor movement is not just cheering on unions, is not just saying democracy's good, but introducing a class struggle program and strategy, how we can take on the bosses and defeat them and win significant improvements in our lives.
Thanks, Philip. Whitney, Stu, and then Peter.
Hi, yeah, my name's Whitney. I'm here in Seattle. I'm part of the Reform and Revolution Caucus, and I'm also a member of the Seattle Education Association. And I just sort of wanted to share a couple of my experiences in the SEA and in trying to enact this strategy and working with a lot of other really great socialists and trying to push for things. Like, the SEA was in many ways the start of the Black Lives Matter at Schools movement, which is huge. There was a boycott 10 years ago, 11 years ago, maybe, around the standardized testing. They really kicked off having a caucus that was organizing this before I got involved in the union. Then I was able to jump in and help out with that. And I just wanted to share some this sort of phenomenon that appeared in our union, where we have a bureaucratic layer, you could say. That is to say, like, leaders who think that like the power is at good negotiations at the bargaining table and doing things smartly and not rousing too much rabble and just being like not organizing the community, not organizing the rank and file, being really scared of these surges, but then in response to these surges acting a lot smarter than in what I've seen from other labor bureaucracies, where a lot of the things have been taken on, or at least partially taken on. So now there is a lot of folks in this caucus pushed for and won a Center for Racial Equity to be part of our union. And now that is sort of seen as just part of the union, and it gets a lot of sort of establishment credit. And in terms of the additional things that have been in terms of democratizing the union, fighting for higher wages, just in terms of COVID, there's a proposal to go on strike in solidarity with the student walkout, and they instead have a rally at this center. So is that a victory? They host a rally they wouldn't have otherwise had, bring together people and get a bit of a better deal than they would have otherwise had. It is a victory that then is used as a cudgel against the people that led the organizing for it to isolate them within the union. And I feel like that's a really complicated dynamic that a lot of times socialists in doing what we do and in doing it really well actually give, we make the bureaucracy a bit better. And that's tough. That makes me want to be really sectarian about it and really like call them out and all this stuff. There's a quote from an old 1940s labor union guy who said in relation to the communist working his union, other people know the name, I forget the name, but he was asked, what do you think about these communists who are doing all this work in your union? And he just said, who keeps the bird, the hunter or the dog? And I think sometimes you kind of feel like the dog in these unions. And I've just sort of drawn a lesson of just really how important it is that we have, that we do systematic organizing in our union to reach people in every workplace so that we don't, we can as much as we can try to counteract this pressure, but that these unions can be turned against us has really been a lesson that I've gotten from my work in the Seattle Education Association, which leads to a lot of burnout from the activists that fought and won a lot of these things. Thanks.
Thanks, Whitney. Stu, and then Peter Landon, and then we have an open stack. So message stack, if you want to jump in. Go ahead, Stu.
Thanks for the conversation so far. I guess as a new, so I've just recently joined a union in Seattle. I'm a plumber. I'm in the UA Local 32 here. I'm also a Reform and Revolution member in DSA here in Seattle. And just in terms of my thinking about the rank and file strategy, I completely agree that we have, like, socialists have to be on the ground actually, you know, talking to coworkers and not just like abstractly cheerleading from the sidelines. But from my perspective, it's going to be quite some time. Yeah, it's going to be decades before I have any impact in my union. And my position is quite isolated and limited at the moment. And in fact, the struggle that's currently happening across the country, but also in Seattle with, you know, Starbucks workers unionizing and like a concrete driver strike from the Teamsters that's shut down construction across the city. Most of those struggles, I myself will have very little impact on for quite the foreseeable future, actually through my union. But through DSA, I do have the ability to have impacts on those struggles. On the political train, DSA can put up a pole of attraction that attracts, you know, Starbucks workers out of, you know, not out of the movement, but, you know, in conjunction with the movement, and can help, you know, provide a centering location for that struggle to cohere, not just between, you know, Starbucks workers, but also between Starbucks workers and, you know, Teamsters. Like we, Socialist Alternative and the Starbucks workers called a rally at Starbucks headquarters that actually got a Teamster to show up and make a speech out of the blue, right? Like these are the kind of solidarity actions that, you know, the trades here in Seattle are absolutely not doing anything on. Like there has, as far as I know, there is no solidarity between the trades who are currently shut out of work on the, you know, basically at home, and picketing Teamsters workers. And what could cohere that kind of solidarity is DSA or other community support organizations that basically are putting pressure on the leadership of trades and other unions to actually come out in solidarity of the Teamsters, for example. But I feel like it's a, you know, I think, what Ty was talking about in terms of, you know, the $15 minimum wage struggle and the way that the political terrain can be used to undercut the leadership of these unions that don't want to go out and actually engage in class struggle is incredibly important. And for the foreseeable future here, at least in Seattle, is going to be our primary viable option.
Great, thanks, Stu. Next up is Peter, and then I'm going to ask Paul to come in after him to respond to the one of the earlier questions to give a little bit of extra time, if that's okay, Paul. Go ahead, Peter.
Hi, I'm a member of the Bread and Roses Caucus.
Well, you're a little
in Detroit, and consider Kim Moody. Yeah, sorry, I'm having problems with my house. That is that any better? Or still mechanical?
A little bit. Yeah, go ahead.
I'm a member of the Bread and Roses Caucus and have been a comrade of Kim Moody's for over 40 years, though I'm not in his current Tempest Collective. I'm having a hard time gleaning or clarifying what differences Tempest and or Reform and Revolution would have in terms of their actual practice in DSA or in the workplace or in the labor movement in terms of carrying out what they have learned from Kim Moody's rank and file strategy, which was not just Kim Moody's rank and file strategy perspective, but a perspective that he and a number of comrades that I share worked out. So if either Paul or Ty could speak to currently existing practice of either the caucus or the collective in terms of your work today in 2022, that might help me understand the nuances relative to what my comrades in Bread and Roses and others in the labor movement are doing and have been doing for decades.
Great, thanks, Peter. Now Paul's got two questions to respond to. Thank you. Go ahead, Paul.
Thanks, Peter. If it's okay, I'm gonna think about that question you just asked.
Sure.
And answer Mick's question from earlier.
That's good.
I think if Mick is still on the call, like otherwise I'd DM you in the chat, but I don't know. We should figure out some way to get connected, first of all. But I think what you said is really critical, and I was going to actually go back to this maybe a bit in my sum up, but yeah, USCW sucks, right? Like, we're a really bad union. And it's really like James, who wasn't on the call, told me that like some of their coworkers at Starbucks was like, well, I don't really want a union because I was in one, USCW, and it sucks. I'm like, well, yeah, it does. And that's really a big issue. But so I would really caution though, against this is where I'll probably go back to this a little bit more later on, but I'll caution a little bit against the idea of like, oh, well, we should just form a reform caucus and take it over. Because like in a grocery store, like most of the people are not going to really make, in Texas, they might not even be in the union. It might be open, it'll be open shop, and they might not, if you're a cashier, you probably don't really care about who's the union president. And a lot of times when I have seen people care, it's with the idea of like, oh, we just need like a better organizer to solve our problems. People have actually said that directly to me, like our organizer who does suck, we like our rep sucks. I'm like, yeah, that's true. Like, we really need something different. I'm like, yeah, that's right. And they're like, we need someone to tell us what to do. And I'm like, no, that's wrong. So that's where really, I think it really comes in, this idea of staying with the rank and file, right? And figure out, like, do you have anyone, is there anyone at your store who you can hang out with and start to talk to about this stuff, right? Is there anyone at other grocery stores you can talk to about this stuff, right? And starting from a group of people that you can talk about this with and, you know, think about some stuff, you know, maybe put out a zine or two, that I think is a really good place to start. And focusing, like, the key is always to focus at the boss, right? Because, like, the problem with the union is they're doing a bad job at representing you and making, you know, but the actual problem is the boss. I wrote a little article about this with a USCW guy up in Brainerd that I know in rural Minnesota that's on Tempest Magazine. Search my name there and you'll see more about that.
Great, thank you. I've got an open stack. Does anybody want to jump in? We've got a little bit more time, about 8 minutes. We can take two more speakers. You can just come off mute if you'd like. Otherwise.
Sarah, I can get on stack.
Great, thank you.
Hi, my name is Sarah. I'm a member of Bread and Roses in Chicago. And I kind of wanted to address what I think is what I see maybe as the answer to Pete's question, though I do want to hear from Ty and Paul and how they would respond, and don't want to speak for them. But I think I want to get away from a sort of binary about what kind of like what work have you done, because I think this work is really hard. And I think the way that the comrades answered about the state of the labor movement, and Laura, Gabby talked about, you know, the difficulties in the carpenter's work. These are obstacles that make it hard to sort of point to clear wins where DSA has been the decisive factor. I think we're really at a stage of, and I think what I hear Paul and Ty advocating for, which I agree with, is advocating for a place of analyzing what steps can bring us forward, and what, how to refine our work in the labor movement, what it means to have a political program. I think what we're seeing and what they pointed to is that there are a lot of labor struggles this year where socialists have not been involved. Here around Chicago, Nabisco, Kellogg's, John Deere, there weren't socialists on the shop floor. And then now with Amazon in New York, you're seeing really what drove those primarily was a greater degree of class consciousness and willingness to fight back on the part of the working class. And so how does that change what we might see as the rank and file strategy within DSA? And how would we refine what we see as a political program for that work? That's what I see sort of as the question coming out of this debate, which I'm really thankful is happening. So that's just more of a comment than a question. I don't know if Paul and Ty agree with that or what Pete thinks of that, but thoughts are welcome. And thanks again for hosting it.
Thanks, Sarah, for jumping in. I appreciate that. Anybody else want to jump in before we kick it back to the panelists? We've got time. We want to hear from a broad range of people. I don't mind the silence, but I will slowly queue up the panelists for their sum up, but feel free to interrupt me. I appreciate that to continue the discussion. So for the panelists, we'll hear for Laura first, and then Paul, and then Ty. Sarah? Yes.
I have Keegan Conrad on the stack.
Excellent. Go ahead, Keegan.
Hello, can everyone hear me?
We can.
Excellent. So, hi everyone, I'm Keegan Conrad, and I am a DSAer out in Chandler, Arizona, as well as a public school educator that's part of Arizona Education Association. But in the future, this coming August, I'll be getting into my master's program for Penn State's labor and global workers' rights, and have these aspirations of being an organizer. For this, and this is kind of just open to anyone that wants to kind of jump, grab on this when it comes to, you know, your final thoughts that you'll have for the panel. When it comes to, again, that's being mentioned earlier, because I'm still grappling around this with labor bureaucracy, and especially for staffers, how could staffers kind of think about how they could contribute to the rank and file strategy? I know that there is some difficulties of what that may be as far as, you know, being part of a position that, you know, has, you know, certain limitations, especially with that strategy, you know, running the risk of if you do collaborate with rank and filers, how they could try to basically, you know, if they have not so great leadership, you know, run the risk of being fired in this case, right? But as far as with, you know, at the same time, you know, things need to get changed, right? So I'm just curious of what, and this is open for the panelists, of what your thoughts are, at least, especially, you know, if Ty, you're welcome to chime into this, since you are a union or a organizer, how could staffers relate to this rank and file strategy and apply this into their unions? And that's my final thoughts on that.
Thanks, Keegan. Maybe there's other staffers on the call or also rank and filers who have advice at how staffers could respond to the rank and file strategy before we move to sum up. People can jump in a little bit more time.
Sarah?
Yep.
I have Lucas on stack.
Take it away, Lucas.
Hey, Luca here. So, you know, I think one of the things that was mentioned earlier is just that, you know, in the 1970s, there were a wave of industrializations, right, of socialists, often from the New Left, going and entering the factory floor. You know, that happened in the United States. Obviously, it was happening in places like France and Italy. And they often were able to do this in really large numbers, you know, compared to, I think, what we've been able to achieve today. At the same time, we all know that, you know, all of these industrialized countries went through the same kind of shock, right, with a kind of capitalist technological leap, deindustrialization by the end of the 80s. What kind of scale in terms of socialists entering to work on the shop floor do you feel like would be necessary to really make that qualitative shift towards towards a successful rank and file strategy, I think, and how do we get there?
Great, thank you, Luca. And then I have Luke Brannigan, and I think that will take us home to the panelists. So go ahead, Luke.
Hi, just a quick question for the panelists. You know, I'm a Columbus, Ohio Reform and Revolution Caucus affiliated. I'm a white collar worker who isn't in a union. And I mean, I feel alienated from a lot of these struggles and within the labor movement. Are there suggestions for workers like me, like how can I get started in my workplace, or how can I show solidarity with other workers who are unionizing? I'd heard Laura Wadlin early in the presentation saying to reach out to people and to find when, you know, major contracts are up, and information like that is always helpful. But in general, yeah, I'd like to know, like, where do I fit into this as a white collar worker who's not in a union? So.
All right. Thank you, Luke. So I'm going to turn it over to the panelists and give you a little bit of extra time. So is Laura on? We would have you kick us off to sum up this discussion.
Yeah, great. Thank you. I'm gonna sum up some of the discussion. I'm also gonna speak directly to like one or two questions people brought up first, if that's okay. One of those was what can DSA do structurally to make labor a real priority in DSA? And I think this is worth me speaking to, since I've been on the DSLC steering committee for 2 years now on the NPC, so kind of seeing it from the inside. I think that though it's controversial and was controversial last convention, I still pretty deeply believe that we need to elect our national director. I think our national director has a huge influence on what gets prioritized in DSA, and how much labor gets prioritized and what that looks like. I think we need to look into the possibilities of new staff structures, which happily our personnel committee has been interviewing, you know, socialist and labor parties around the world on what their staff structures look like and comparing different models and comparing that to DSA. You know, we were set up kind of in this more NGO structure, you know, when there were just a couple thousand members and a couple hundred active DSA members, and we're still, we still have that structure, basically. So I don't think it necessarily works for us anymore. And I think there's more to do to figure out what would be best, but I think that's a problem. I think having elected leaders who work full time on this is going to have to be some sort of shift, because right now we are a very staff driven organization. All of our elected leadership are for the most part, like working other full-time jobs. So it's like doing politics in your off time. So that's reflected at like every level of the organization. I think electing MPC leadership who will prioritize labor in a real way. And this necessitates building a deeper base among the DSA membership for this. So we can't just run a bunch of like, you know, candidates who want to do labor work. Like we really, really have to build that up in the DSA membership. I'm afraid I'm not going to be able to answer that other question. So I'm going to keep, I'm going to kind of sum up basically some main themes that came out for me. I think it's clear we need the rank and file strategy in DSA. We need to be guided by the thought of socialists who are deeply part of the labor movement and central in the 1930s. We need to be guided by Kim Moody's thought, Solidarity's thought, the IS's thought, Labor Note's successes. And we need to develop particular strategies within industries, workplaces, and unions. But I'm going to say those need to be developed and guided by socialists working in those industries. We can't just be outside these industries, you know, trying to develop or like theorize about what strategies would work. Hence, we need to get people there in the first place. You know, I think the rank and file strategy will never live fully in DSA. It needs to be built up really from the ground in DSA. And I agree with a lot of what was said that we can't just be cheerleaders from the sidelines as DSA members. However, I think we need to get extremely good at the basics and essentially an approach of like, we need to learn to walk before we can fly. I think a lot of people in this room have been involved in this for a very long time and like studied this deeply. But I think in DSA, we're not gonna go from 0 to 100 at the drop of a dime. We're, you know, many DSA members are very new to the socialist movement. I mean, I've been in the labor movement over 10 years, but I myself have, you know, only been in, you know, an official part of the socialist movement since late 2016. We're not going to go from having no involvement or relationship to labor work to leading the Flint sit-down strikes just like that. We need to build up the kind of deeper labor solidarity work that Portland DSA is doing. And that needs to really happen in every chapter and reach out to every single DSA member. And it, you know, sometimes might feel like cheerleading from the sidelines, but we need to do those basic things good before we can even start to get to like another step up. And it also means that we need to be, you know, to develop these strategies within industries, we need to be there. So we need to get people to be there. I don't think that the rank and file strategy is just like people get jobs and, you know, and are suddenly, you know, that's the only thing. But I think that there has been a huge focus on getting people into industries because we're not there. And that's a precursor to even being able to develop these strategies. You know, a couple of years ago, we didn't have a lot of DSA members in the Teamsters and in logistics. Now we have like a critical mass in some places that we're actually seeing these strategies being developed. But we really needed to get some people there first to like really get their feet wet to be actually developing those strategies. So I'm gonna go ahead and leave it there, but thanks.
Great, thank you, that was great. Paul, next.
Yeah, thanks everyone. This has been just like, honestly, so much fun. So thanks. First of all, I just wanted to say, Peter, I have so much respect for all the solidarity. I love all this stuff. When I saw you and James Slaughter and Joanna Misnick and Kit Lyons and all these people, I was like, oh my God, ah! So, you know, I'm with the people I'm in now, but it's not because I don't have any, you know, I have respect for every socialist, right? Okay, most socialists. So I just wanted to say that. You know, I think going back, one thing I really want to talk about first is like really be clear, like Kim Moody's writing, what is always interesting to me is this tactical flexibility and how his eyes on stuff. Anytime you read something that he writes, there's always like a reference to some reform movement, and you go and you're like, what was that? I have to go call Joe Allen and ask him what he's talking about here. And like in On New Terrain, his book, he's doing another book, but his most recent book before that, he says that IWOC, the prison worker organizing campaign by the IWW, is like, he's says that's part of the rank and file strategy, right? So he really does, is that what most people in DSA are talking about? I don't know. I didn't heard it referred to it before, but like, it's a really great framework to think about this stuff is go start from the politics and be, because the other thing I wanted to quote is from the theses on workplace organizing from the Sojourner Truth organization, Nadia's group, who I also, hold a lot of respect for. He says something that I think is really, really important. They say this in their piece. When union struggles involve masses of workers, communists should be there. However, at times when the level of mass struggle is not high and the revolutionary current among the workers is weak, communists must be particularly conscious of the danger of entrapments and schemes of union reform, which in fact isolate them from the workers. In such conditions, particular care must be used to distinguish the position of revolutionaries from that in reformists, such not just in rhetoric. Essential to this is the development of mass organizations able to deal with the problem of workers from a position of independent strength. So I think that's important because, for them, they were in, just as a background, they're in the steel industry in the 70s when there is a rank and file challenge. But Molly Gnadiev writes, he was in like the worst part of the steel industry, like at the, the nastiest part of the mill. And the workers there didn't really care about the people on top. And like, that's important when we start to think about like the Teamsters, where like a lot of part-time workers in UPS and like, overall only like, I think it's great that like Sean O'Brien won, but it's only 14% turnout, which is pretty low, right? So when most people aren't voting, that signals that we should do something more than just, right? So that's the kind of one thing I want to put out there. From the movement that the kind of tradition that Kim Moody comes from, a big emphasis they talk about is workplace councils, right? Like in the British tradition, they talk about this guy, J.T. Murphy, who we wrote an article about for Tempest, but he started something called the National Minority Movement. It was about focus, again, it's kind of what I'm going for, like get your friend, figure out the people you have in your workplace and start talking to them and see where you can go. I think what Stu said was really, really important, right? Like, you're probably not going to be like getting the UA to like endorse socialism like in the next 10 years, right? But you're going to get a few friends, right? And start talking to them about being a plumber, which sounds like really cool and fun. Like, I'd love to be a plumber, right? That's, you could be, Stu the plumber. And in the meantime, you have this great place, DSA, where you can do the other stuff. What Luke was saying, right? Like, that is, if you feel alienated from the struggle, well, you have DSA, you have a place where you can talk to these people. And that's really important, right? It's important to not just, be second to ourselves, but it's also important to be, paying really attention to your coworkers and what's going on. I did wanted to say one last thing, which is I do also want to, we have to be, I think strategic sectors are important, but we have to also, we can't really predict the struggle, right? Like, I don't think anyone predicted that the union that went on all these strikes last year would be the BCTGM, right? Like, not really on the radar, and in the meantime, you might have thought like, oh, well, in this big pandemic, right? Like, all of the teachers' unions will have this like big mass strike since there's so many radicals there. But that didn't really pan out because, the workers were really beaten down. And in nursing, still a lot of great organizing, but there's all these agency nurses now, right? So things change and we don't know what the situation is gonna hold. The thing that I caution about against, like in the 70s, Dr. Lois Wiener told me this, there are a lot of workers who are, a lot of socialists who are starting out white collar jobs, and working in, Kim Moody got to start organizing as like a welfare worker in Baltimore. And they're like, okay, well, the action is, in Lordstown, the action is Drum, the action is the steel mills, the action is the mines. But then they all got fired when the recession came around. And in the meantime, if they had, she's kind of like, well, if we had only stuck out in the teachers, right? So, you know, like as much as it's important to be in these sectors, like we have to think about where we are too. So it's really cool that there's like a tech workers coalition that's like helping out, you know, like workers organize in service workers organizing tech campuses. It's really great that the grad students are organizing and being in UAWD and help and starting to meet the auto workers. And, you know, as a film nerd, I was a film major. It was so cool Thursday to see the workers at Anthology Film Archives, which is like a really, really, you know, important, for those who don't know, which is probably most people, it's a really important like film theater in New York City for experimental film, one of like the two most important in the nation. They went on strike and I'm like, you know, that's really cool, right? And is that like strategic? You know, I don't know. But like, we have to, like, it's cool that all these, it's important to be, to do this, right? Because we value art, right? So we have to be thinking about this in a broader sense, is I guess just the last point I wanted to make.
Great, thank you. All right, we'll turn it over to Ty.
Well, yeah, this has been a really great discussion. And I think, you know, sometimes I know in my chapter of DSA, Tacoma DSA, there's a, you know, often a real nervousness about having opening space for debate and disagreements. And there actually have been less disagreements, at least expressed here, than maybe the framing of this discussion would have implied. But I think it's a model, you know, I think it is possible to talk through difficult ideas, to talk through disagreements where they exist in a very healthy way, where we can learn from each other, listen to each other, and, you know, have the, you know, not have a false humility. We all have our ideas, we have experiences that inform our positions, but also, you know, to understand that we are, you know, continuing to make the road and trying to figure out where to go. And that's not easy. I got my start in labor politics when I joined the Cleveland Labor Party in 1997, and, you know, was really inspired by Tony Mazzocchi saying, you know, the bosses have two parties, we need one of our own. I'd watched the Clinton administration, you know, pass NAFTA, betray, you know, a lot of the hopes around healthcare and all the rest. And I was optimistic. I thought, you know, you know, WTO protests happened. I thought, man, we are, you know, we are on the way to a workers' party, to a revival of mass struggle, toward a revival of revolutionary politics. And it's been a long time since then. And the reality is the last few decades, the experience that, you know, most DSA members who are younger than me, younger than a lot of, you know, experienced activists in this room, have lived through a period of, you know, a historic low level of strikes, a period of decline of labor politics, labor activity. I think there is, and this room evidences it, you know, the potential to sort of pass the lessons of the past generation on that exists and that's being cultivated in DSA. But by and large, the young radicals that have emerged in the struggle over the last several years are, you know, trying to reinvent the wheel in a certain sense, are not educated in the traditions and the lessons of the past. And there's a break, I think, in of the past socialist and labor tradition. And there's, you know, people who are trying to research and make those connections, but it's not easy. I think one of the biggest mistakes in that context, though, is for people, and I feel like, especially after Bernie's defeat, there's sort of this sort of mood of sober realism that kind of has permeated DSA, where people feel like, you know, the idea of a workers' party, yes, that's our goal. That's 20, 30 years down the road. The idea of a labor revival, yes, that's our goal. But, you know, you're going to have to dig in, wait a decade or two, and then, you know, then maybe you can build a reform slate. I don't want to, you know, my own life experience has been a lesson against false optimism, but I think we are an exciting moment. Joe Burns was, to reference him again, he was on a Labor Heartland Forum a few days ago. And this is before the Amazon victory in Staten Island was announced. And he was saying, you know, he's saying, you know, I don't know, but I feel like, you know, we could be in for a really exciting period of a major historic upsurge in labor movement. A lot of ingredients are there, from the tight labor market to just the mood of anger to the young workers that are coming up with a higher set of expectations. There's a lot of ingredients that could spark quite an upsurge in the next period. I'm not making predictions, but I think all of the labor work of DSA, I think we need to recognize that you know, the history of movements, the history of struggle is not usually of, you know, the sort of, you know, in Marxist term, the mole of history that is gradual, but then it often develops in explosive bursts. That's the lesson of history. And there's a lot of explosive material that is, I think, ready to burst right now. How that develops, whether that can be given expression, a lot of that depends on how well the left and the socialist movement get organized in the years ahead. If we have groups of 15 Teamsters and chapters across the country in the run-up to the negotiations around UPS next year, that's not a small thing. Somebody asked, you know, what's the critical mass before the rank and file strategy can really take off? I think in some ways, if DSA, you know, if I think the scale that DSA has right now, if it was well organized, if we could sort of develop a coherent policy, if we could do trainings and develop our people, and we are doing that, but you know, step that up, which is more subjective questions than objective. I don't think it's the numbers. I think we are in a good position, actually, in a lot of places, in the teachers' unions, in the nurses, in Teamsters, in the baristas. But it's going to be a question of how well we're organized and how much we are prepared when workers move. Kim Moody, one line from his pamphlet, he says the rank and file strategy is based on the idea that in periods of heightened class struggle, the rank and file become inactive rank and file members suddenly become active, suddenly become politicized, suddenly move into struggle. And we, in many ways, what we are doing in periods like, you know, the last few years and now even is preparing the activist core, Paul made a similar point, activist cadre to for those moments of explosive struggle when the rank and file moves onto the field of history to be able to organize, provide ideas, enter dialogue, ideally be in dialogue in advance, and, you know, arm them with the ideas that are going to be necessary to struggle. And I think, you know, what happened in Amazon this week is that, you know, without, you know, Chris Smalls was hanging out with some socialists, getting some good ideas. Clearly he was absorbing a lot. There's ideas in the Communist Party or something had some activists in the plant. I don't know, but, you know, there's probably ideas there, but I think the more organized and coherent the socialist movement is, the more we can win. The last kind of point I wanted to touch on that I think was asked about, but maybe not sufficiently developed. I do think in DSA, the issue of political independence from the Democratic Party, not just how we run candidates, but what our labor policy is going to be crucial. I gave the example, the local example of Minneapolis, where that played out in such a stark way in the fight for 15. If socialists hadn't been there fighting with a clear policy of labor independence from the Democratic Party, of understanding the dangers in advance and preparing for them, of warning activists in advance of the role that the Democratic Party was going to play in that city, the role of labor's alliance with the Democratic Party was going to play in that city, I feel very confident we would have been, we might have won 13, we might have won 12, 50, we would not have won 15, we would not have won as much. The PRO Act, I think, is an example of in the opposite direction. Unfortunately, you know, labor did not do, the unions did not do what we did. There was not a systematic agitation. There was not DSA did great work, but the labor leadership did not systematically mobilize the millions of workers to put maximum pressure on Biden, on the Democrats, to pass this. There were not mass coordinated demonstrations in cities across the country in the run-up, you know, last year, and when there was maybe a possibility of passing the PRO Act. And that was because, I think, of labor's ties to the Democratic Party, and because they don't want to embarrass Biden, because they are tied to a strategy that fundamentally flows from a very low set of expectations about what's possible, and does not flow from a class struggle analysis. So I think there is a politics that DSA needs to discuss more systematically. To me, you know, I support I'm forgetting the name of it all of a sudden. I think it's not wrong that in certain circumstances, DSA uses the ballot line of the Democratic Party. But I think, you know, there is a need for to put a greater emphasis on the break, and especially in our propaganda and our messaging in the labor movement, and more generally, putting the idea that we are aiming for a new political party, we're aiming for independence. And even in our day-to-day activity, we disagree with tail ending and limiting our demands and approach to what is acceptable to maintain the alliance of the Democratic Party. So I've got the wrap up sign. So I'll just, I didn't properly answer. I think none of us did. What's the difference between R&R and Tempest and all the rest? I'm not sure is the truth in terms of rank and file strategy. We had a different approach on the Bowman controversy, and you can read our material on that. And I think there's things that can be touched on, not a dramatically different, but I think there are differences, but I think I look forward to continuing to discuss, debate, dialogue. I think we have a lot to learn from one another.
Great. Thank you to Ty, and thank you for everyone for grappling with these issues in a really exciting time. I wanna extend a special thank you to all of the speakers, James from Starbucks United, Laura Wadlin from Portland DSA and the teachers union there, Laura Gabby from the MPC and BNR, Paul from the Tempest Collective, and really everyone who contributed to the discussion today to develop our understanding. Thank you so much. Thanks also to the Comrades in Reform and Revolution for organizing this discussion. R&R is going to be doing this once a month, and the next one would be Sunday, April 23rd, same time. Details and RSVP link should be coming up in the chat. If you want to engage in the work that Comrades are doing, first of all, join DSA at dsausa.org. Get involved in your local chapters. A lot of them also have labor working groups and committees, and that is the very clear place to get active. If you want to support R&R, you can subscribe to our magazine at reformandrevolution.org/subscribe. And you can find more details there about joining us and what we do. So thank you, everyone, and enjoy your Sunday. Take care.